welcome back to Camera Creations, a podcast where me and the team, or the team and I should say, talk about films, digital cameras, photography, anything to do with lovely, lovely photography and cameras. So I'm joined today by, let's see, we've got Chris Clayton, Chris Kelly, and Joe Hickey, and Charlie Winston, and no Ian Bundy, and no Ed House. Hello, chaps.
Good evening all.
Everyone happy? Yes, indeed. We're all happy with the weather, apparently. We were just talking before we came on air about that. So tedsalmon.com/camera creations is our website. And we have the MeWe group, where you're very welcome to join us. Links in the show notes to that. You'll also find links to everything at tedsalmon.com. Camera Creations Shared Album is where we chuck stuff in that we're going to talk about on the show. So they usually stay up for the duration of the fortnight between shows. So if you're listening to the podcast, you can click on the link in the show notes to that and follow along and have a look at what we're talking about. We don't have any feedback from the last show. Obviously, no one listened to it and no one's interested. So we're going to go straight on to the... if no one listens to this show, I'm quite happy still to chat with you guys about it. So let's not worry about it. the feature for today's show is GAS. Now, tell us, Chris C., what GAS means.
Gear Acquisition Syndrome. Which is something we've all suffered with from various degrees, I think, of rapidly hoarding up all kinds of tech to try and improve our skills, or in the false hope of trying to improve our skills.
Although some of us have suffered more than others.
Yeah, I was just going to pass it on to you, Charlie, because Charlie has given us a rather exhaustive list of his very... busy last 2 years of photography, which I think is his entire photography career. Is that right, Charlie? 2 years?
Yes. Two short years, yes.
And there's a headline pound figure that you spent, which is quite alarming. But
it's quite large, I think. I think I could have bought a Hasselblad with a lens for that amount.
Or a house in some places.
or a house in Cambodia, yes.
All joking aside, though, it's quite worrying, isn't it, that a person can get, I've no idea how much millions of pounds you've got, but it's quite worrying that anyone could kind of go through that and spend such a huge amount of money upgrading and moving forward and trying things out. And presumably that figure doesn't include having traded stuff back in, does it?
No, it doesn't. I mean, it's a large figure. It's quite sad in a way, because what have I got out of it? I think I would have got the same results had I spent, say, £1,000 all in, as opposed to 15 or 16,000 over 2 years.
Yeah, I think, Charlie, you should actually say what this figure is that we're alluding to.
16,300.
Wow.
Yeah. One thing I will say in your defence, though, is I spent a lot of money on alcohol in my youth. Maybe not that amount, but definitely that was wasted.
Yeah, this is the thing. We've all got
I almost
our vices,
certainly have and
we?
Still spend it.
And I can attest to the fact that Charlie's very boring. He doesn't do anything. So all that money that he saved not doing anything, I guess, is
I do nothing. So, I mean, like, I'm a teetotaler. You know, I do go away, but what else am I going to spend my cash on, you know? So although it is quite a lot of money, I haven't spent it on anything else. So
You could give some to me.
Yeah,
I could buy a telecamera. Rico, Ted, how about that?
Yeah, lovely.
Charlie, you should talk about, like, the upgrade that you've recently made, because this has come at a fortuitous time, this conversation.
Well, it all started with the A7IV, I think. That's what I bought originally in October 2023. And I didn't like it because it was too chunky. It was too big in my hands. It wasn't ergonomic. So after about a month of use, or of no use really, I just couldn't get on with it, I exchanged it on Amazon for the A7C II. And I really enjoyed that camera. My first lens with that, also, I recommend anyone to get it as a beginner lens, was the Sony FE85, and that was quite cheap. I got it used for about £250. And then quickly after that, I was going to the Far East, and I upgraded, well, I say upgraded, more like a downgrade. I bought the 20mm lens f1.8 off Chris, I think, for about £550. Didn't use it once. I don't even think I took a photo with it. I didn't know what I was doing. I was still new, and it's a 20mm lens on a full frame. So, you know, that's more architecture, more advanced. Didn't know what I was doing. Sold it after like 3 weeks. And then I bought my favorite lens, which is, and there's a bit of a story here, the Sony 40mm f2.8. Fantastic lens, really small. Doesn't make the A7 C2 pocketable, but you could still use it. And what I did was I used it for a year, sold it because I bought the 35F 1.4, which is obviously in tech terms, in spec terms, it's better, but it was too big and bulky. So I felt guilty. I had two lenses of a similar focal length. Sold the 40, felt really bad, and immediately bought it back again. so I was worse off. You know, I paid twice for it, basically, for the same lens. I felt really dumb. And I probably might even end up buying it back again. And then what I did was, even more stupidly, was I went out, bought myself a Ricoh, which was the Ricoh GR3X, which is a 40mm focal length. So not only did I buy the 40mm Sony, sell it, buy it back, but I bought a second camera with a built-in non-detachable 40mm focal length. So at this point, you're probably wondering, you know, I should have a psychologist or something, you know, for my spending habits. But that's where it all started. And then it just went downhill, really. You know, started with more, bought a tripod, spent £550 on some filters that I've only used once, and photos were terrible. Bought all the Peak Design gears, bought four bags. I've got a mini sling, a medium-sized sling, an extra-large sling from Peak Design for a tripod holder. And then I bought my puffy bag, Wonder. What's it called, Chris, the bags we have?
Wondered.
My Wondered backpack.
Revoke. Wondered Revoke.
Yeah, and that's a 31-litre backpack. That costs like £280. But I must add that I did get all the things inside it. You get like the things that hold your camera gear together, whatever they're called. They're like £50. That came with it.
Partitions,
yeah, all of that good stuff. I remember I even bought the Peak Design, the little wrist strap. And that's like £50 for a piece of material. But granted, it does have a magnet in it, so it kind of like wraps around quite nicely. And then on top of all of that, not only did I buy one camera strap, like a big chunky one for my main camera, but I bought a thinner camera strap. And these are Peak Design ones. They're like £50-60 each for my Ricoh camera, which is really sad because the Ricoh is designed to be put in your pocket. Obviously, so I had two camera straps. I also had the wrist strap. I sold my A7 C2 last week, and I bought the A7R Mark V, which has an RRP in park cameras. Don't go to them; they're terrible. For £3,300, but I got it imported from Hong Kong. £2,059. It's a wonderful camera. I haven't been out and shot with it yet. and then I sold half my lenses to kind of cover the cost of that camera. And then I bought another two lenses. So I bought the 9mm by 7 Artisan. And I also bought the Samyang 14-24mm, which was about £650 from... I can't remember where I got that from. I think I got it from E-Infinity. So that's where I am at the moment. And also in between there, I also bought many other camera lenses. I think the camera lens, excluding the 20mm, which I never used, the other one that I didn't really use was the Viltrox 28mm. That was a fantastic lens. I went to Brighton Pride with the flash on my camera to use it because it was really busy. Didn't use it once. I ended up changing it and using the 35 1.4 because that was just gave me... I didn't have to get so close to the subject, so that was quite good. What else did I do? I also bought a tripod, the Ulanzi Zero Y tripod, which retails for around £150. I have seen some stores selling it for £250. I got it for £150. So, yeah, I mean, I've spent quite a lot on lenses. I also bought the 135mm Sony F1.8, which is a fantastic lens. But I'm a bit stupid here because I'm a street photographer, primarily switching more into environmental photography. And this is a portrait lens. You know, you don't buy a portrait lens. You'd buy a like a zoom lens. That would have more versatility. So I had that, and I was actually doing street shots in London with the 135, which was ridiculous. But I did get some really good shots with it, and I only used it once. And then after a year, I sold it.
So what was the buying cost and the selling cost on that 135 that you used once?
So it, oh, you have to do this to me, don't you? So it retails, its RRP is £1,900. I bought it for £1,400 new from, again, eInfinity. Got that imported from China. That was my most, excluding camera bodies, that was my most expensive lens. I'm feeling quite unwell now talking about this. I must say, I think I have to lie down and take some paracetamol. Yes.
So what did you sell it for? Come on.
I can't divulge that information. I didn't get much for it. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
But the problem is on eBay, obviously they've changed their policy. So you can't, before you could choose your courier of choice and insure it and everything. But now you have to use like Every or something. And I've lost stuff I've sent with them. So I had to do it through MPB. So I didn't get the best rate for it, I must say.
Oh, yeah. I'm tired listening to that, Charlie. Are you feeling okay?
Yeah, so I have spent quite a lot on them.
But you were also you're also selling stuff in amongst that and trading in, and so if you took the outlay of £16,300 in October 2023. Yes. The balance of books, how much would you actually be down, do you think?
Yeah, so I would say on average when I'm selling a lens, if I buy a lens for 1,000, I would usually sell it, I would get at least 60% back, so I'd lose like £400 mm-hmm. usually. It depends on how popular the lens is. With the Viltrox, I recently sold that to MPB. I bought that for 300 and I sold it for 220. So that number at the bottom there, 6,300. Obviously, that's not what I spent.
Yeah,
16,300, yeah. But I would obviously get money back when I sell the products. So you can't
say what the balance of the books are. You can't say that now you're £12,000 down or whatever.
No, I haven't actually recorded it properly like
okay.
I should.
Okay.
Yeah, I should know better, really.
Right. So what's the logic then? What's going through your head when you're doing... What is GAS all about here? Why are you doing this to yourself?
I think really deep down it's probably insecurity. I probably want to be someone or something I'm not. You know, I'm not a very good photographer. Most of it's down to luck and timing, not really so much of the skill of who I am as a photographer.
I disagree. I mean, I think you make your own luck as a photographer. So I'm going to back you up there.
Thank you. I think it's more of a numbers game, Ted. I think it's, hedonic adaptation. So there was a study done in the late 1970s called the Brinkman study in 1978 or 1979. I can't remember the exact year. You can look it up. Where they did a study on lottery winners and people who were recently injured and became paralyzed in accidents. And what they found was that our happiness basically has a baseline. So if you win the lottery, you're really excited, or if you're in an accident, obviously you're very sad. But after several months or years have elapsed, you go back to your normal baseline. So if you were happy before you won the lottery, you'd still be happy. Or if you were in an accident, you'd still be happy if you were happy before it. What I'm trying to say is here, when you take pictures, buying gear makes me feel good about myself. But once I have bought it, I go back to how I felt before I bought it, back to my original baseline state, if that makes sense.
That dopamine hit.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, basically.
I can understand that because, you know, when we buy new stuff, there is a buzz about it, and particularly the anticipation. If you leap down to my notes in the show here about GAS back in the 80s for me, one of the fun sides of photography, I think, and camera buying was the hunt, the going out and buying amateur photographer every week and studying all the ads and looking at and getting them to send you photocopied reviews in the post in those days. Every monthly magazine I used to get, weekly magazines too. I think for like 20 years, I just bought everything that was published out there. And I can remember going to as many cameras. So if I had a day off, I'd go to all the camera shops that I could possibly go to and just gaze longingly at all the lovely gear and then getting Magic Lantern guys. You'll remember those, Chris Kay, and Ho Fountain books. And every time I got a new camera, that's the first thing I did. You go and buy one of these instruction books. And they were really good. They were very well done. Michael Huber used to be the author of those books, and it was great. But the point is that it was always about the anticipation and the planning, and it was about teasing yourself almost. And I can remember, you know, the night before I'd done all my research, and the night I was going to bed the night before, and it's like a kid on Christmas Eve going to bed because you know the next day you're going to pick this camera up or this lens up or whatever. And there's a real buzz to that. And so I completely get what you're saying, Charlie, personally. I don't feel that buzz quite so much anymore, but back in the 80s, I absolutely did. And almost, there's almost a collapse when you've got it, as you were just saying. Almost, it's like you go back to normal and suddenly you realise that all of that buzz and that feeling was about the hunt and about the chase and about the anticipation, not about actually having it and using it.
I would say, Ted, you still have got that buzz, buying different things.
yeah. We won't mention phones. But the same thing for me is, you're absolutely right, Joe, at the moment, you know, now I can get that same buzz from a phone arriving, and then quite possibly I'd do a review for 6 hours and write it all out, and by the end of that I'm kind of fed up with it. I've gone back to another phone. So yes, you're probably right. But sorry, back to your Chris, sorry.
I was going to say I'll now make Charlie feel much better. So back in the day I did all that with the camera gear as well. But I haven't bought any camera gear for over a decade. My current fetish, unfortunately, is motorcycles. So just to put this into context for you, Charlie, so you can feel so much better. Well, in the last 4 years, I'm only allowed two at once by the wife, but in the last 4 years, I've had 8 motorcycles. The one that I bought 6 months cost me £17,000.
Gosh.
I'm going to look at one tomorrow, and the RRP on that is £25,500.
That's a lot. Certainly a lot more than my camera
about
gear.
It now.
I think what we're doing here with the camera gear is, you know, we have to be honest with ourselves. It's marginal improvement, often costing thousands of pounds for a 1% gain. So it's diminishing returns, isn't it? It's a very, very small improvement that you're definitely getting, I feel, but you're doing it to kind of compensate for something that you don't have, something you're lacking, where what you really need to do is just have, like, you know, time in the game. You just need to spend X amount of hours on the street or in the studio or in the workshop or whatever, practicing, honing your craft, as opposed to justifying buying a new lens. Like, I really want the f2.8, and Chris will know about this, Chris C will know about this, the f2.8 70-200 lens. But I know it's going to be too big and heavy and impractical for me to actually make use of, just like the 135 lens. You know, so I have to kind of hold myself back and stop myself. You know, we're all trying to improve ourselves, but I don't really think throwing money at gear, you know, gas, gear acquisition syndrome is necessarily the answer.
What I found is, to a point, is what I just picked the best of that thing. So I looked at the Sony cameras and I picked the best Sony camera there is. So then there's no temptation to think, well, it's the camera that's holding me back, because there isn't a better camera. So when I pick a lens, or a prime lens, or any of the lenses that I have, I pick that the best version of that lens, the best Sony lens, the best Sony GM lens. Then I know that if I'm not getting the shots, there's no way it's anyone else's fault but my own, because I can't improve on the gear. So I think throwing money at the problem does kind of break that psychological barrier of...
Is your justification, though?
I've got a justification as well.
Some people might not have the money to buy, like, the A7 R5, which is a very expensive camera. They might only have enough to get, like, a Ricoh or something like that. But it might just not be the best case for their money. It might not be the best use.
Yeah. But I think, to going back to the buzz that we spoke about, I think it does help, because that buzz, once you get the gear, it gets you back out. It gets you motivated again. It gets you back out shooting more, which then does improve you, because it's like we keep saying, it's all about that practice. So that's my justification. It gives you that motivation and that buzz again.
I definitely found that with the 9mm. I went out to London with just the 9mm, and I got some of my favourite shots in London, because it does get you out there. It does force you to look at things differently. And I feel like I definitely improved my photography as a result of being kind of restrained into that kind of ultra-wide angle. But that's a £300 lens.
Yeah.
Before you guys' time, did any of you ever watch the Digital Rev YouTube channel?
I watched him as Kai W, but not as Kai Digital Rev.
So on Digital Rev, they used to have a regular one, which was cheap camera, professional photographer. So they would give stuff that was, you know, plastic fantastic with little kittens on and real crappy cameras with plastic lenses. And they would give them to professional photographers, and they'd send them out, and they'd come back with just some amazing photographs. But again, it's because they have gone through this and they've built their craft over time. So they've been there, but they've come through the other side, if you like. And now for them, the buzz has perhaps transferred from the gear itself to the challenge of making the image with whatever's in their hand. So maybe one day we'll get there, fellas.
Yeah, I'm a long way off that. But yeah, one day.
Okay, Charlie, go back to your list of highlighted points about this disease.
Well, I think what Chris C was saying earlier was interesting about the 9mm lens, which I might add I also purchased and haven't really put it to good use yet. But when you buy, you know, new gear, don't you feel like, you know, it's a new tool, you're buying it and you're forcing yourself to use it in a situation without justifying how you're going to use it. Surely the scene should dictate how you're going to set the frame up and take a picture, as opposed to buying a new piece of gear saying, right, I'm only going to use it this way, trying to frame everything in the 85 mil or in the 9 mil or in the 35 mil, as opposed to just going out with the lens that you have and trying to fit it to the scene, if that makes sense. You know, like the idea that if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. I think that's what I'm trying to say. If you buy a lens, you think, oh, I can only shoot with a lens in this way. But I think that's the wrong way to look at things when you're buying gear, because the lens you buy shouldn't dictate how your shots should be. It should be the scene that's guiding you.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, sometimes you do try and fit the square peg into a round hole. I found that with the 70 to 200. I took that out and just that one lens to make myself use it. And it, you know, there's only so many compositions that you can get with a telephoto lens.
But you've just said it. You said it there to make yourself use it.
Yeah.
That shouldn't be what we're doing as photographers.
No, you're right.
It should be the scene that's guiding you, you know.
But I have kind of worked out when I should use it. I'll talk about later when I used it. So I think it's a learning process. And I think I'm kind of happy with the lenses I've got now, and I know when to use which lens, and I not really feel like there's anything I would need to add to my lens catalogue. So
The only counter I'd have, if you go to the same location again and again, it's quite nice to go with different focal lengths.
Exactly. That's where that 9mm came in so good for me, going to Brighton Beach or going to London, and I've never, even with my phone that could do 13mm, having 9mm is quite a big jump on that. So
yeah,
getting pictures that I'd literally never taken before was a lot of fun. That's been the best lens I bought, you know, excluding the drone probably, which I count as a lens in its own right, in terms of giving me creative options. But again, that was such a cheap lens, so it goes to show that you don't need to spend crazy amounts.
No.
And there's a lot to be said for having something that's quite different from what's already in your bag. And I know what you're saying, Charlie, about the scene should dictate what you're trying to do. But there's the other side of developing as a photographer, stepping out of that comfort zone to force yourself to, and I've done it in the past, you know, instead of going out carrying my bag full of all sorts where I've got a fair range, I would deliberately go out with one lens screwed onto the camera and go out and make myself see these other options, these other images that I wouldn't have otherwise considered if I hadn't constrained myself in that way.
Yeah, I think the danger here is that with gear acquisition syndrome, it shifts you from creating images to justifying the purchase, which is quite dangerous. It shouldn't really be like that. If you look at it as a whole, you know, the amount of money I spent on, I mean, obviously I wouldn't spend 16 grand on a holiday, but if I spent, say, £1,500, £2,000 on the camera lens or £3,000 on the camera lens, that money might have been better spent going traveling, going on holiday, because I would learn much more in the streets of Vietnam or Japan, taking photos, being in a new environment, seeing things in a different way, just with the normal lens on my camera, than staying in London or Brighton and just buying a new lens and seeing the same thing day in, day out, trying to justify the shot with my new fancy lens, which is fine, but I don't think from a cost-benefit perspective, it's the right way of doing things. There's always an opportunity cost when you buy something. You know, you could buy a new lens, but you can also pay money to go on a workshop and learn something, although I'd never do that. Or you could pay the money to go on holiday, and then you get much more bang for your buck. You know, you get a higher rate of returns, you know, pound per pound for your photo taking versus staying where you live and playing about with a new lens, I think.
This is getting depressing now. Let's switch.
It's true, though, isn't it?
I mean,
we'd all learn a lot more, you know, instead of spending all that money, actually. And you don't even have to go, you know, to Tokyo or wherever. You could go to, I don't know, Ireland or France or somewhere closer to home, or even somewhere else in your own country. And this brings us, you know, to another, you know, pertinent point. You know, there's this idea, this kind of mental model called the map is not the territory. And it's the idea that, you know, if you have a map, a chart, you use that as an abstraction of reality to understand your journey, where you're going. And I think we can look at this, you know, with photography and buying gear. You know, specs and charts are only representations. They're not the final photo. So you can look at, like, spec sheets for how sharp, Chrissy would know about this, how sharp a camera lens is, you know, how much of a high dynamic range it can capture and whatnot. But those are just distractions from, you know, composition and timing. You know, what I'm trying to say is we're confusing technical potential with real creative output. We're treating the camera lens as like a map, you know, a map as an abstraction of reality. But the camera lens, it's not taking the pictures. I mean, it is taking the pictures, but the camera lens isn't the creative output. It's you, the human, the button pusher. You're the creative output. And we're just looking at specs and charts and diagrams on these lenses to try and think, oh, well, you know, that's going to make a better picture. But really, it's just pattern recognition at the end of the day. That's what determines what a good photo is, and luck as well. But I think you pick up luck as you go along when you're learning photography. It's just, you know, the amount of hours you put in that determines, you know, how good the image is.
Which takes us back to the putting a toy camera in the hands of a professional and getting good results, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think I did see a video once. I tried to re-find it and I couldn't, on YouTube. It was a few years ago. They basically got, they called it a toy camera. I don't know if that's a certain type of camera, literally a toy camera, or if that's a style of camera. And they got like these five professional photographers. They took away their Nikon, or they took away their Canon. They actually physically took it off them, and they gave them like this plastic, like $10 bright yellow toy camera in the middle of Hong Kong. They said, okay, there you go, off you go, go out, take a photo, see what you can do. And of course, they actually took some amazing photos with these terrible cheap toy cameras. And I just think that really shines a light on, it's not about the gear you have, is it? It's just about how good you are as an artist, which is what a photographer is, how good you are as a person that can represent reality through a two-dimensional image.
Yeah, it's totally. Perhaps that was the same experiment, Chris Kelly, that you were talking about earlier.
Sounds like it, yeah. That was in Hong Kong.
Yeah, so it probably was the same thing, wasn't it? But yeah, there's a challenge. But you wouldn't have that itch scratched if you didn't have the GAS in there, would you?
Well, it's a bit like a flywheel, isn't it? I think if you just have any old camera, and this is how it started with me, I just had the 85 lens, and then I took a picture, and I actually liked the picture, even though I didn't know what I was doing. It was just blind luck. And I took another picture, and that was quite nice. Granted, I took like several hundred pictures, but between those several hundred, some of them were actually okay. And that's kind of what created the momentum for me to actually go out organically, most importantly, just to go out and just take more pictures. You know, I wasn't doing it, you know, obviously I don't make any money from my photography. I wasn't doing it because I had to do it. I just did it for the creative process because it was fun, essentially. Mm-hmm. What I find most enjoyable isn't so much taking the photo, because once it's taken, it's taken. It's more before and after. So with before, it's the planning, going onto Google Maps, Google My Maps, scouting out the locations online, trying to work out the geometry of where I need to stand to get the picture I want at the time of day I want it. And then you've got the post-processing, which I think Chris C would understand, you know, all in Photoshop, how to edit an image non-destructively, how to do it in such a way where it looks good and not artificial. You know, so a lot of the processes that we talk about with photography are the before and the after, the past and the future. It's not so much about the present moment, because once you press the shutter, you know, that's just a split second, isn't it?
Yeah, sure. And does that bring into play some of those post-processing in these days, digital tools? I don't know, Chris C, if you get gear acquisition syndrome, not just on camera hardware, but also on software.
Oh, God, yeah. Never thought about it, but now you've said it. Yeah, so I don't do it now. I think I've come over the, I've sort of gone over the brow of this gas problem, and I've kind of cleared everything out, and I'm happy with where I am. I think so. I'm happy where I am, but yeah, for sure. I bought presets. I've stuck with Adobe, but obviously I bought the Adobe subscription. I bought the Luminar Neo subscription. I've bought God knows how many plugins.
Didn't you buy the Denoise plugins,
DxO Denoise plugin, all kinds of plugins, presets. Yeah. I don't even want to think about it, to be honest, because most of all,
they're intangible. It's not the same as a camera lens. You know, you can't pick it up and smell it. You know, it's just
the Fuji. Because when I had my Fuji camera, I really liked the film sims, which obviously I lost when I went to Sony. So there's a company called Cobalt Profiles that
I bought that. I never used it.
Oh, you did as well. Yeah. Do the Fuji film sims for Sony cameras.
Yeah,
and that's like all in. It's about 90 quid. So I bought that, and I never really use that. So, yeah. Yes, Ted, to answer your question.
Yeah, same thing applies. Okay, yeah. Charlie, any final points in your rundown?
Well, I think, you know, what we've touched on, you know, it's all about identity, isn't it? I mean, you know, we feel like gear becomes a shortcut to feeling like, you know, let's face it, to feeling like a real photographer. If I buy X, I'm going to be a better photographer. Mm-hmm. But I think that's further than the truth, to be honest with you. Buying replaces practice as a source of self-validation.
Sure.
We want to feel better, you know, within ourselves, not so much as a photographer, but as a human being. You know, we always have degrees of, you know, comparison with other people, and we feel like having an identity, I am a photographer, makes you stand out for whatever reason, and that's why we buy these things that we don't need. And we're probably, you know, we're probably manipulated by what we see online. I don't know if you have this, but on YouTube I actually have a third party plugin that blocks everything on YouTube. So if you go to my YouTube account, you just see a black screen with a search bar. You don't see any videos, because if you go on it, it's just full of YouTube videos about camera gear and camera reviews and where to go to get the best shots, which is just nonsense, isn't it? You don't need to rely on other people, on secondhand information, to be a good photographer. You look at the people 50, 60 years ago that were taking pictures. They're fantastic, and they didn't have the internet. So it is a lot about identity and how we want to portray ourselves to other people. And I feel like people are using buying other things, other camera equipment things and gear, as a shortcut to doing that, which is wrong. You know, it's capitalism, isn't it? It always tries to get you to do something that you wouldn't otherwise do. And I think we should really take a strong look at ourselves in the mirror and say, well, we don't actually need this new lens or anything. Like, for example, I just bought myself...
Yeah, you're a week too late, aren't you? Because you just...
yeah, I'm a hypocrite. Just because I'm a hypocrite doesn't validate my argument. I bought an eyepiece cup for my camera because I wear glasses quite a lot of the time when I shoot. And that cost me £30, and I'm importing it from America, which is absolutely absurd. You know, who would have thought that I would be spending £30 in 2025 for a rubber eyepiece to mount to my camera. I mean, it's nonsensical almost, really.
See, I think it makes sense. Maybe I've got it really bad, this GAS.
You're not a long jagger, yeah.
Joe, take us through some of your thoughts on it. That's a good segue there.
Well, I never knew this was a thing that existed. I had to Google it. But yeah, the more I think about it, everyone I know who likes photography, they do want to buy more and more all the time. So yeah, it's definitely a real thing, and I've got it. In actual fact, I think I've got ADHD, right? And a trait of ADHD is you get into hobbies and you go all in. You get GAS really bad.
Yeah.
But hopefully I'll stick with this one because I enjoy photography. I think with my GAS, it's even the small things. So the first thing I bought for my Panasonic is spare batteries by a small rig. They're USB charged, which is
nice. They're amazing.
Yeah,
I love those batteries.
High capacity. They are really good. But the main reason is I bought them is because there's orange and blue. Black batteries are boring. So
I didn't buy it for that.
Well, the USB-C and the high capacity is the main reason, actually.
Yeah, you can charge them when you're actually on the go, which is incredible. The Sony batteries are terrible. And the Sony charger, the proprietary charger that comes with it, actually has its own cable. So you've got to plug it into the wall. You then got to plug this box to the cable. And then you've got to slot the Sony battery.
It's clunky, into the box.
But it's not magnetic. It's like clunky. It doesn't go together. Mm. It's just horrible.
So, yeah, that was my first purchase, and I thought that was a good one. I did an impulse buy. The silly Instagram ad got me by Retropura Lens, which is a disposable lens, but for full-frame cameras. So you can get them for most mounts. It's very gimmicky, but it is fun to shoot with. And that's one of the reasons I do photography, for the joy, for the fun. I know I'm not great at it, but I enjoy it. But you have to use that in good light.
Joe, when you say a disposable lens, so when you shoot it,
you just throw it away. No, it's you know, like the old disposable cameras. It's a lens from that, made for different mounts.
Oh, I see. That's
disposable camera lens.
Yeah.
That's quite fun. I've added one image while I've been talking to the Camera Creations Google shared drive thing. Yeah. And I mean, you can see the image in there of the trees. It's blurry and around the edges. It's not a great image, but it was fun to take. And that's what I'm in photography for, quite partly. And I've dropped my affiliate link, if it works, if anyone's interested in that silly lens. I was over the moon when I got my 50mm f1.8 prime lens for a decent price secondhand. This is what makes GAS a little bit more palatable when you get a second-hand price rather than new. It's become a great buy, actually, because my last short that I made on my YouTube channel, shameless plug, has come out really nice, and the bokeh with the Christmas tree. I've had quite a few comments on it, so I'm really proud I bought that lens. That's where it has made a difference with my content, having the gear. I've also recently bought an overhead camera mount for drop-down shots, so unboxings and demos and stuff like that. It's lovely, actually. It's really sturdy, freestanding as well, so I can move it about in other places in the house if I want to. I think that's going to come in really handy, and some people would argue I don't need it, but I would argue I do.
And then it also comes down to money, available money and cost. Or I suppose some people would just go into debt to do what they want to do.
Well, we see a lot of these things I'm buying are relatively low cost. And the one thing I did, which was more, was the 100mm lens, which I got for my birthday. But yeah, my GAS is little bits and bobs here and there. There is a lens I do want, which is quite pricey, though, which is the 100 to 500mm Lumix lens. I don't know if I'll actually use it much, but I guess that's GAS, isn't it? I really want it. I also have the urge to have more cameras, which I really don't need. I really want the Panny S9, which is a downgrade from my S5 II. I don't want it to replace the S5 II. I just want it as an extra one to create content with, so I could set up a tripod and my overhead, for example, and not have to move the camera about. And it's also could be a carry-around one because it's slightly more lightweight. But then on the flip side, I also feel like I need another lightweight camera that's pocketable and, much like you say, Ted, that I can have with me more. Despite me enjoying mobile photography, it's just not the same, is it?
No.
It's definitely not.
No.
we've touched on this already. I've said about there's always the idea that gear will make you better. And I think there is some truth to it in a sense that, like I said, it does get you more motivated to start shooting again. And it's all about the practice. And if the gear is going to help you go out and practice more, that's a good thing. But sometimes you do think, do I need it? Like I went to the zoo with the 100mm lens only, which isn't the most ideal lens, but I did learn a few things about the lens by doing that. And about myself as well. I'm rubbish. And I recently started exploring personalization of my gear, which is partly GIS as well, like skins and different straps. And again, is this all necessary?
I'm always looking at that Alpha Guard website and skinning up my camera. And I think, but it seems like a right path to put those skins on.
Joe, if you're going to skin your camera, just go to AliExpress. They're the same product.
Yeah, that's what I've looked at. Yeah, I found that because... they're much cheaper.
It's the same as everyone else. It's just
exactly the same. You can see the images are the same, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Yeah. So yeah, that's
this is a bit like a bejazzle for your camera.
Yes. Yeah. Very much that.
was that the kind of thing that Ian was showing off with his yellow housings, or is that different?
So he's got this is different. What I'm talking about, you know, extreme skins for phones.
Yeah.
It's like that. Dbrand. It's more like that. But
stick them on, right?
Yeah, but what Ian's got is something that interests me as well, though, because it does add that little bit of protection.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but anyway,
that's more like a housing. Yeah.
Anyway, to sort of personalise my gear really is appealing to me.
Mm-hmm.
But that's again, is that GAS? I think it probably is, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose so. And I think a lot of it does come down to available funds. And if you haven't got any money, then, people can go into debt, of course. But laying that aside, if you haven't got the money to do it, then you get on with what you've got. If you're enthusiastic enough about what you've got, then you'll presumably go out and use it. Or maybe you won't. You'll just, the hobby will die and it'll be...
See, yeah, that's I don't want that to happen. See, I think... Like I say, with GAS, I've got it definitely, and I can't afford the lenses I want.
Mm-hmm.
But to fulfil it, I buy these smaller things like the batteries, like the personalisation. The skins don't cost that much; it's affordable. The Retropia lens is a stupid little lens, but it got me out for a little while. It's these little things that I can buy.
Maybe that's something slightly different. Maybe that's to do with. The need to be that to have something new rather than gear acquisition syndrome, slightly different to just new and shiny.
I guess it blurs a bit, don't they, the two things?
Yeah. I think like you buy for gas, it's more because you feel like you're going to be a better photographer. Mm-hmm. You'll improve, but what Joe's talking about, and I think what I definitely had with phones, was you just wanted the new phone. You just wanted... I used to go through, you know, as you know, when I was into phones, you know, 5, 6, 7 phones a year, just to get something new, something, you know, to keep you interested.
Yeah.
So I think it is slightly different, because obviously you're not going to be a better phone user, are you, if you keep buying phones? But, so it must be a different psychology behind it, but also the same, if that makes sense.
Yeah, like they blur together.
But it's kind of interrelated, isn't it? It's more about the novelty. So, Chris, you were saying about phones, and I can relate to that because, like, you could do, like, modding on the phone as opposed to actually buying a phone. you can skin it up, you know.
Which like, I did a lot on my Galaxy Nexus. I used to do that.
Yeah, like Nova Launch or something. So we're chasing not only new gear, but novelty. Now, obviously, you can't update the OS on your camera, which is a great shame. I wish I could do that on the Sony because the UI is absolutely abysmal. But, you know, we're always chasing this novelty. Oh, can I have the latest gear, the latest camera? But, I mean, these cameras are high tech. I mean, they can do everything. There's no need, really, for us to go out. I mean, my A7R 5, it's 61 megapixels. It shoots incredibly at night. There's just no need for me to go out and buy any more gear, really.
Well, that's what I was saying earlier. Now you've peaked. There's no upgrade path. So there's no temptation to sort of get something else.
I've screwed myself, basically.
Else, it will be worse.
Yeah. There's no need in GAS.
No. Mm-hmm. Unless I buy myself a medium format Hasselblad.
Ah. Oh, yeah, I suppose you could, yeah.
I could. Otherwise, I can't really see how I can one-up myself.
And then it'll be a 5x4 plate camera. And yeah. there'll be no turning back from when you get into large format. In that right, Chris?
£60,000.
Yeah. Chris K, did you ever use, when you were doing your photography stuff, courses, a big plate camera?
No, we never got to that stage. But I was just thinking, you may have reached a peak in terms of the vertical gear acquisition, but there's always the horizontal dimension. So I've got a couple of studio flash heads that I used once as a friend of mine got his own business, so he asked me to do some product shots for him. So I bought stands and flash heads and brollies and soft boxes and all that nonsense just to do this one shoot, which I got paid for, but it paid me probably about a tenth of what I'd spent, and now they all just sit there in the spare room unused, unloved.
Might buy some of that off you.
Feel free, yeah.
Yeah.
You can have it for cheap as chips because it's just sitting there gathering dust.
I've just realised that we're nearly an hour in here and we haven't got to the catch-up of the week yet. So let's dive in there. And I'll just start with something that Anders Hagman has put in the group, which is really interesting, I think. He's got some coloured gels going on and he's been using a flash. He says that he used a joystick kind of setup, I think, and he got some gels. Presumably the gels have gone over the front of filters on the front of his lens, and
The flash, Ted.
Sorry? Oh, it was over the flash, was it? Okay. And he's fired the flash at the smoke coming out, and it's made a really interesting and beautiful kind of dancing smoke patterns. He's done this with an SB900, so I presume it's Nikon gear, and it looks really interesting. I think that's the kind of photography that I would really be interested in kind of looking into, creating art rather than going and, you know, taking a picture of the Taj Mahal or whatever. But yeah, any thoughts on that, Anders Hagman stuff?
I really love these. I'd love that as a wallpaper, and I'm really tempted to have a go myself. I've got a flash that Ian gave me, and I've never actually used it. I don't know anything about flash photography, but this seems like a kind of a good way to experiment with it. So I might give this a go. But do you know, I should probably ask Anders in the group, but would this be in darkness or when you take this image? Like, yeah, you turn all the lights off?
I think so, yeah. And you'd have a black backdrop as well. And the flash needs to be fired from the side, because otherwise you're going to illuminate.
Not on camera.
Sorry?
The flash wouldn't be on the camera.
No, right, you need to do it from the side, because otherwise you're going to illuminate the backdrop, unless it's a long, long way away, of course.
I see.
If you set a relatively low power on the flash, if it's fairly close to the smoke, you're going to get massive fall off. It's inverse square law, so the further away it is. So you could set it with a fairly low flash. You wouldn't need massive distance to the backdrop.
Right, okay. So he recommends YouTube videos by somebody called Gavin Hoey, H-O-E-Y, which I'll try and find a link to and put in the show notes, because he said that he's found lots of inspiration from what this guy was doing. I got a nod of approval there. You've heard of him, have you?
Yeah, I've certainly seen his work. He's pretty darn good, yeah.
Okay, so we'll put that in there. And, yeah, thanks, Anders, for throwing that in the group. In the Camera Creations Photos shared album, there's also a couple more from him, including one of his cat.
Yes, a lovely shot of his cat.
I like a cat.
A Santa cat.
I really like that.
It's a lovely little portrait, yeah. But there's
that's
more
a flash photo, there's, I presume.
I don't know, yeah. There's natural light reflecting from the eyes. By the looks of it, it looks like a window to me. Anyway,
I think that one needs a caption from the cat saying, "Oh, the indignity."
but those smoke pictures, there's more than one in that album, is what I was going to say. So just do go and have a look. Chris C, let's leap back to you and talk about your fortnight and what you've been doing with your photography.
Right. Well, despite my close proximity to Seven Sisters, well-known kind of landscape spot, I've never taken a sunrise photo there. So I thought, right, I'm going to write this wrong. So a couple of weekends ago, I think the weekend after our last podcast, got up early with the intention of getting out to Seven Sisters, getting the sunrise. But I looked on the weather app, it was 95% cloud cover and there was a fair bit of cloud. Like, even though it was dark, I could see it was kind of cloudy, but thought, I'm going to go anyway, I'll give it a go. And as I was driving there, it was getting cloudier and cloudier, and I was so close, I got to Lewis Roundabout, I thought, I'm just going to go home, this is going to be rubbish. But I thought, no, even if there's no light or no sunrise, at least I'll be out, at least I'll be there and getting some fresh air. So I soldiered on, and I did park up at the top of Seven Sisters Cliff at about 6:45, and sunrise was set for 7:30. But the colour started sort of coming through really quickly, because at the top of the cliffs it was kind of gale force winds, it was freezing, but it did mean that it pushed the cloud out really quickly. And I will direct you to the photo group there, because the pictures are kind of in order of the sunrise. So you can see the first image there, bright red sky, that was taken at 7:00, so half an hour before sunrise. And I was greeted to these amazing colors for the next half an hour, during which time I was kind of running around like a headless chicken, trying to think what's going to be the best composition. I want to get this light right, I don't want to waste it, you know, because it was just the best, probably one of the best, most vivid sunrises I've ever seen. I've seen quite a few. I've put the best four images up there. And as you can see in the group there, you've gone from 7:00 with the bright red sky until, let me check this, the metadata shows at 7:35 to a few minutes after sunrise. And you've got kind of the purple blue skies. And I basically just took the same shot but a variation of it. It's a classic shot. It's not a new composition. You've got the houses in the foreground, very famous Coast Guard cottages, I think they're called, and you've got obviously the Seven Sisters cliffs, and it kind of works as a leading line right to the back of the frame. Then you've got the lighthouse on the cliffs at the back. And it was just a fantastic kind of half hour trying to get the best shots. I used my 70-200 for all of these photos, mostly taken at 70 mil. So in hindsight, I think I probably should have used my 24-70 as a lighter lens, because the wind was so strong that it was actually blowing the tripod over. So the heavy lens on top probably didn't help, and I couldn't really get long exposures sort of beyond a tenth of a second due to the wind. So I had to kind of play with the ISO, play with the exposure time, and obviously I wanted to keep that depth of field as broad as possible to get the houses in the foreground and the cliffs in the back. So I was hovering around between sort of f8 and f14 for most of the shots, experimenting. Took I think I ended up with about 300 photos in all in that half an hour, I think it was. But most of them were kind of just the same photo over and over again. So I just wanted to make sure it was clear as possible. So I was pixel peeping Chris, that lighthouse right in the back.
I really like your last, the second to last photo. Could you talk me through the editing process in that?
Because
it looks like not a cartoon, but like it was made digitally, like a piece of art. It's really good.
So once I got all these photos, obviously over the moon with the colours, and I couldn't wait to get home and get editing. I edited as soon as I got home because I was so sort of buzzing with the pictures that I got, with the colours I had. And the trouble was that the sunrise was so vibrant and so vivid that I didn't really know what to do, because normally I'm adding colour and I felt like I needed to take it away because it was so vibrant. It almost looked fake. Like, so in the group there, you can see the two orange photos, the second and third photos. In the notes, they'll be reversed, the darker one and the brighter one. So the one with the darker houses, that's the raw image. That's straight out of camera with no edits at all. So that's a representation of how kind of vivid the sunrise was. And I think I was trying to do too much. So you can see in the edit there, I've brought the shadows up, and I think I've flattened the image too much, and it kind of looks unnatural. So I kind of came back a couple of days later, and this is the image that I was most happy with that you've mentioned there, Charlie, the kind of the purple image. This is bang on sunrise.
This one, in my opinion, the editing.
So this was taken at 7:25, and you can see it's like just as the sun's cresting over the horizon. Mm. And what I've done there is I've actually reduced the shadow. So I've plunged the foreground into basically complete darkness. There's the tiniest bit of detail in there. But I've just used that to create the contrast with the bright sunshine behind it. And I haven't brought the highlights down. Even though that detail was there in the highlights, I've kind of deliberately blown it out just to balance the scene, because otherwise I feel like it was too dark. And that's what I was struggling with in the edits, was trying to retain the highlight detail. But I decided just to lose it and keep the shadow detail in the cliffs, so not go too heavy with the exposure or the shadows in the cliffs. Keep them dark, keep the skies kind of natural. And then I think what that does is it sort of exaggerates the gradations of the colour in the sky. You've got the dark purples, the oranges and the reds all clearly visible without any distraction. And I think the surrounding elements just kind of lead you to the sunrise. So that is the best image I got from the weekend, is that one bang on sunrise. But yeah, I really, really did struggle with the edits, because I'm someone that just edits and edits, and I feel like I had to do too much. And the lesson I learned was that sometimes, you know, restraint is the way to go. So a very productive half an hour, surprisingly challenging the edit, but super happy with at least one of the images. And I don't think I'll ever see a sunrise like that again, especially at that location. So not much point in going back there, I guess, now.
I think the cloud form really adds to the image as well.
Yeah, it was so windy. I mean, you can see like the clouds are all totally different because, you know, minutes have passed, and it was such, the wind was so strong, it was freezing. I was the only person there. But, yeah, the cloud was essential for those colours to kind of refract through the sky. I'm really, really happy. One of my favourite landscape photos of the year. And I've been doing a bit more landscape lately as well, after sort of being stuck on architectural stuff. So really enjoying that. Really enjoying sort of getting out there in the cold, actually. Weekend after as well, just quickly mention, I took my 9mm out for the rather sort of depressing Christmas lights we have in Brighton, but I thought I'd do it a go and try and... It's a bit of sort of end of the pier, crappy British Christmas lights. It's not exactly Bangkok Light Festival, but I put the top look-up shot of the clock tower, Brighton clock tower, with the lights coming off it in black and white. I quite like that shot. That's with the 9mm. That was a half-second handheld exposure, so it's not tack sharp because it was half a second, but I like the contrast, and I've not seen that composition before with that edit, so happy with that. Also, had a go at a light trail, but I didn't really like the results. I have put that in the group. Felt it was too messy. The 9mm's too wide. It's captured too much, and the clock tower's kind of totally obscured. So
I don't like the yellow grid thingy on the road. I think that kind of...
It's distracting. I tried to use it as a leading line, but you're right, it doesn't work because it's not symmetrical and it's distracting. But I gave it a go. It was horrible as well. It was so busy. It was about 8 o'clock on a Christmas sort of shopping night.
Mm-hmm.
And I had all these people going, "Oh, take me a picture." And it was... and I was just like, hold myself. It happened, you know, so many of them. I was just like, oh, leave me alone. So, yeah, it was a learning experience.
Yeah.
That'll teach me, won't it? I'll stick to the empty cliffs.
It'd be interesting to see you have another go at light trails, which is what I think Charlie was doing with his little Rico in the last show or the show before. Charlie, you've got a tale to tell surrounding the photographs that you submitted, and I think you've broken the rules, haven't you?
Oh dear, I certainly have, yes. Well, I actually planned this one. So I went to London last week on Friday, and I planned to go to God's Own Junkyard in London. So I went there. It was quite a journey. And by the time I arrived, I got my camera out. I had the 9mm f5.6 on my Sony A7C2 before I sold it. And I had it all prepped, all prepared, took my camera out, it was in my hand, and I proudly and confidently walked in through the door, brandishing my camera, to be greeted by a big neon yellow sign saying, "No cameras strictly allowed." So I was like, right, okay, let's find a staff member first. So I found a staff member, and she just said, "Oh, no cameras." I was like, "Well, no cameras at all." And she said, "Well, you can use your phone." Like, that's what? A camera. She said, that's a camera. I said, well, no, you know, it's a phone. She's like, yeah, you can use your phone. Said, it's a camera. It's like, well, yeah, but it's not your camera, is it? I said, they're both cameras, you know, so you're letting me use one camera, but not the other. And she goes, well, you know, I don't want you taking photos professionally. I'm like, I'm not. I'm just doing it as a hobby. She's like, well, where are the photos going to go? I'm going to go nowhere. I'm not posting them or anything. I just like to take photos and edit them at home. So, well, you have to use your phone. So I was stuck in this environment, and you can see with the photos here where the lighting was quite dark and it accentuated all the neon lighting. So the 9mm would have been perfect. I had to use the Samsung S25 Ultra, which is okay, you know, for that, but I would have preferred to use my camera. I put it on the widest lens, I think was 14mm on the Samsung. Took several photos. I was there for about 25 minutes taking many photos, but I was there with all the other normies and they had all their phones out taking photos. So the pictures I got were okay, but it's not the same as using a real camera, a real full-frame camera.
It's just not as satisfying, is it?
Yeah, it's not as satisfying. I couldn't, there's no aperture control, I don't think, or if there is one on the Samsung, it's like a fake aperture control. There is a shutter speed control, but it's not the real thing. It's all touch screen, it's all going over the place. It's not ergonomic, it was horrible. So I went there, and then it just went downhill from there, really. I mean, that was like at midday. Then I went to the Church of Immaculate Conception. I wanted to go in there with my 9mm. You know, I really wanted to get those wide-angle shots. And they had some kind of congregation or something. So I couldn't go in there. I didn't want any people there. It was too busy. So then I tried to go to the Sir John Soane's. Sir John Soane's Museum, I think it's called, and they took offence to my backpack. They said, "You can't come in with that." I said, "What do you mean?" They said, "No backpack. Oh, you're not allowed a tripod." I said, "Well, I can leave my tripod with you. It's not that. It's a backpack. You can't come in with it." I said, "Well, what's wrong with it?" They said, "It's too big." So, okay, I thought that's pretty bad. So I thought, well, don't worry. I'm going to go to the Canary Wharf car park.
Going back to the bag, was that to do with security because it might be a bomb?
No. So basically they told me that there's a risk of me knocking things over because it's quite
right.
Tight in there. So they said the tripod's out. because even if I'm not going to use it, they say I can knock things over because it was like sticking out my bag.
Right.
And they said my bag was too big, which it is, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
It's only 31 litres, but they said you're not coming in with that. So that kind of messed things up for me. So then I thought, well, I've got this composition plan to look up shop at the car park in Canary Wharf. Can't remember the name of the car park, and it's like a cylindrical kind of look-up shot from the ground level. So my first problem is I get into the car park, I'm on foot, and I try and access the ground level, and the first two doors to access it were locked. So I went through the third door on the third floor, and I managed to get in, and it's the car park. The only way down, because the other doors were locked, was through the ramp, and there's signs everywhere saying you can't access the ramp on foot. And there were cars coming down, it was very busy, so I kind of chickened out at this point, and I was losing the natural light anyway. It was quite dark in there now. It was almost 4 o'clock. So I didn't go down to the bottom floor and get my photo I wanted. So I thought, oh, it's okay. I'll go to Monument Underground Station, I wanted to get some light trails of the buses going by. Well, it was too busy, number one. Number two, no buses came by. So I was waiting 20 minutes for nothing. I was going to do a handheld shot because there were too many people and rest my camera on the railing by the road. I already had it planned. I used Google Street View to plan it out. But no buses came, so I was just ended up standing there by myself like a Wally. So then I thought, okay, well, it can't get much worse, can it? Well, it did. So I went to Piccadilly Underground Station, and you couldn't walk. There were too many people. So then I went to Big Ben, and my usual spot, they have, like, the pavement, and then there's, like, a cycle lane, and then there's, like, this miniature, like curb, I guess you can call it, not really a pavement, with bollards on it. And I thought, okay, I put my tripod on there and get my my shot of Big Ben with some light trails of the buses. But I couldn't do that because there were tourists standing where I wanted to be, taking pictures of themselves, selfies with Big Ben in the background. So I was completely deflated at this moment, and I just thought, well, you know, it's 7:30, I'm just going to go home now. And I just went after that. So the only photos I got for the day were of God's Own Junkyard. I did take some photos of Big Ben, but they weren't very good, and they weren't on the location I wanted. They were from across the bridge, so I didn't even add them to the group. And you live and you learn, you know, that's what new acquisition syndrome gets you. That's what new gear gets you. Gets you absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
At least you had a go, Charlie. At least you got out there and had a go.
Yeah, at least I got out there.
Your problem was being, you're following the rules. You're asking staff for permission and you're following no walking signs. Just crack on and wait for them to have a go at you afterwards. That's
thank you. Thank you, Charlie. Just bear in mind, people, that in the album, those three photos from Charlie are taken with a phone.
And, they're taken with a phone.
And not with a lovely camera. Chris C, you're going to have to fly through this week's news, so go for it.
Oh, God. Yeah, I forgot. Okay, finally, the Sony A7 5, after months and months and years of... is it coming, when it's coming? It's finally out, came out yesterday. You probably saw the deluge of YouTubers gushing over it. £2,800. This is the Sony's hybrid offering. So they've really leaned into the hybrid. The A7 IV, its predecessor, was more stills focused. At the time, 33 megapixel, quite a high resolution. But this one, they've really pushed the video specs more than the still specs. It's kept its 33 megapixel sensor, but it's partially stacked now. So much quicker readout speeds. So rolling shutters pretty much eliminated for the most part beyond sort of edge cases. It's got, on the still side, it does have pre-capture up to a second, which is kind of table stakes for these cameras now. 30 frames a second in the electronic shutter and 10 in mechanical. So it's kind of, it's come out, it's the last one to come out of the big manufacturers to offer the kind of their mid-range hybrid camera. Nikon Z6 III, Canon R6 III, and the Lumix S1 II all came out in the last few months, and it's kind of right in the middle of all those. Some parts better, some parts worse than the others, but I would say it's a good upgrade from the A74, but if you're steals focused, I would skip this, go for the A7R5, to be honest. So this is only if you're really into video that it makes sense, in my opinion. But it's finally come out, so we can stop going on about it in the rumours, at least. But yeah, so this will be Sony's kind of big release. It will be their mainstay camera, and the A74 was the best-selling camera ever, I think, full frame. I doubt the A75 will follow on, but it will be their main one for the next 5 years or so.
Okay.
So that's Sony news. On to some comedy news, Leica Q3. Shame Ian isn't here, because he might be a bit more favourable than me, being a Leica Q3 fanboy. But the already £5,500 Leica Q3 have released a £6,000 version. You might be wondering what that £500 extra pound buys you, and it buys you no colours.
No colours?
No colours. So for a £500 premium over the regular Q3, you can have a black and white sensor.
So it's baked into the sensor, mono?
Well, so all sensors are black and white, but they have these Bayer filters or something over them. I'm not sure on the technicalities, but this removes that, so you get left with a black and white sensor, which is meant to
take something away and charge more. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Capitalism.
Well, they say you get better noise levels. Yeah. I mean, I can tell any difference. I've watched all the videos and the side-by-sides, and they looked identical to me, as if just the black and white of a normal Q3. But they sell out. People buy them. But, yeah.
Hmm.
Comedy camera for show-offs. That's what I put in the notes, and I think sums it up.
Or people with real serious GAs.
Yeah, oh yeah, for sure, yeah. But yeah, maybe Ian, when he's back, we can ask him if he's up for one of these, because I know he misses his Q3. I just want to mention quickly this Chinese manual lens. This is from a company called Brighton Star, which I've not heard of before, but this is an
f0.95.
So you're going to get insane depth of field, 50mm. It's fully manual, but the thing is, you've got a 50mm f0.95 lens for £280.
Wow.
Ordinarily, I'd go, oh, that's going to be rubbish. But after I bought that 7 Artisans 9mm, I think, for similar money, I think this, if you're someone that likes portraiture, I think this is worth a shot. You're going to have a lot of fun with a
an
aperture F9. Ring on there.
It looks nice, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know, that's, and it's available for your mount, Joe. It's available for all mounts.
Mounts, really? Wow.
Yeah.
Gosh.
So, I mean, that's kind of almost impulse money. So if you're taking pictures of dogs or people.
Hang on a minute,
kids,
Chris. Will it make me a better photographer if I buy it?
Yes.
I remember Fujifilm made a sub F1 lens when I was using Fuji. Do you remember that, Chris? Chris C, when you were playing about with Fuji stuff?
Was it a Fuji's? I vaguely remember it, but was it a Fuji branded lens, or was
it? I thought it was. It was definitely, I think, the same as that,
f0.95. Yeah. It's not the first time I've seen something below F1, but I can't remember what the others were.
Amazing.
But it's just the buying for that is so cheap.
Yeah.
The pictures look good, so I'm really desperate to find a way of buying this lens and using it for something, but I'm struggling to find a use case.
Start doing some portraiture.
If I had kids or something, I'd definitely pick
or animals. Before we've just got time before we go, we're running long. Joe, you got a plug for your mate's book.
Yes, it's a lovely coffee table book, which I highly recommend if you've got family members who are into wrestling or photography or both. It's called Shutter Clicks and Super Kicks by my friend Greg Scoop Boxley. I put a link to Amazon, but you can also get a digital copy if you want, but I wouldn't. I'd get the physical copy because it's lovely to look at. There's some medium format portrait shots in there. He's a Sony shooter most of the time, but he's also got a Fuji as well. But some amazing shots, action shots of wrestling in there. I highly recommend it. Check it out.
Cool. Thanks very much. Okay. We were going to do a back to basics shutter release cables feature in there, but we really haven't got time. We're running so long. So we'll leave that till next time. Thanks ever so much, everyone, for joining me. It's been a blast. It's been a gas, in fact. TedSalmon.com/camera creations is our website. You'll find all the links to all the stuff we've been talking about in here today. There's also links to the Camera Creation Shared album, so you can see the photographs we've been talking about while we go along. You can get all of the links to our audio podcasts and all of our MeWe groups at TedSalmon.com, and you can join us in the MeWe group. Yeah, so do join us in the MeWe group. Links in the show notes, and show us the kind of photographs that you've been taking with your camera, and we'll bring highlights of that to shows going forward. Thanks very much, and we'll catch you in 2 weeks' time when we might even have some sort of Christmassy theme. You never know. Take care, everyone.